Welcome to Confessions of a Saab Psychologist. Today, I am chatting with Emma van der Scaif about social connectedness through video games. Emma is a PhD candidate in cyberpsychology at the University of Sydney and also teaches two undergrad subjects, human development and innovations in e-health. Welcome, Emma. I'm so delighted to have you on board.
Thank you so much. Really excited to have this conversation today.
Emma, before we get chatting about the work you do, can you tell me a little bit more about who you are, what you do, and what the pivot point was that sent you down the road of cyberpsychology?
Absolutely. So my name's Emma. I'm a PhD candidate in cyberpsychology, and I'm studying at the University of Sydney. And my research is on social connectedness in online communities, with a specific focus on video games. So I guess my journey into cyberpsychology is probably very similar to a lot of guests that you've had. I was very interested in studying people and understanding people. So I did my undergrad in psychology, and that kind of spurred a bit of an interest for me. So I was really passionate about mental health and how we can support people to flourish. So that was kind of my entryway into cyberpsychology, I guess. And then I was also influenced by some amazing researchers at the University of Sydney, Dr. Andrew Campbell, who's my supervisor and has been a mentor for a really, really long time. And he has been on the podcast, a fantastic episode. And he set up the first cyberpsychology research group in Australia. So I was very inspired by him and his journey, and also by the amazing cyberpsychology research group at UCIDS. So Dr. Christina Amon, Dr. Rowena Forsyth, and Dr. Brad Riddard as well. That was what got me into cyberpsychology.
So your honours and PhD research has been on video gamers. And I've spoken to a number of people on this podcast about video games, and there's lots of different aspects of video games that we're exploring as cyberpsychologists. What exactly are you trying to understand in researching the social connectedness and online communities of video games?
Absolutely. It's been so fantastic to see you highlight so many incredible researchers in this area. It is a very complex area, and there's, as you mentioned, lots of different, you know, avenues for research and perspectives. So it's really fantastic to have that as a sort of breadth on the podcast. So that's really awesome. In terms of what I'm studying specifically, I'm looking at social interaction and relationships. So how online game environments impact the formation of friendships and social connections, how they're, you know, formed and how they develop and how they're maintained, the role of in-game communication, voice chatting, messaging, and how those can strengthen bonds, and also video gamers' perceptions of their relationships online and through these video gaming platforms.
And what are you not researching?
Yeah, very good question. Like we mentioned, huge scope of things to do with video games. That's a small subsection of what can be researched. I'm not looking into children or neurodivergent specific communities. So that will be reflected in our conversation. My findings don't reflect those communities. I'm not doing intervention style research. So I'm looking at how individuals play in their sort of natural setting. And I'm not looking at serious games, so games developed specifically for behavior change. So some games, you know, developed, for example, to try and impact people's behavior. I'm looking at commercial off-the-shelf video games.
Why do you think your PhD research is so important to study?
Good question. Video games are extremely widely played. So there are estimates of, you know, up to 3 billion people worldwide are engaging with this medium. So we know that they're incredibly widely played. We also know that modern video games have an incredible capacity to be able to connect people as they've developed and with all their sort of new features. And we also know that community is really important for mental health. So I think the research is really important because it bridges those things. So sort of isolation and loneliness, social connection element with also this video game sort of beast that lots of people are engaging with. You know, it's really important we study the effects of video games. So considering their sort of function, how people are engaging with them. So is it leisure or professional gaming, which is sort of this new kind of gaming that's happening. Their content, you know, action adventure, you know, massive multiplayer online games. There's so many different ways of engaging through video games. The platform can make a difference, you know, PCs, mobile, handheld devices, Discord, which Dr. Rachel Coet was talking about as well on this podcast, which is really fantastic. And also the context within which people are playing. So solo play, but we know that people also engage with one another in multiplayer games and also through social networks.
Because also there's a lot of parents who kind of don't know a huge amount about the online games and how they actually work now. So that's really interesting. Because we during our initial discussion, we spoke about X-gen parents who grew up with a different type of video game experience than what today's young adults engage in. And for most X-geners, which I am part of, it really was about them versus the machine. And you would either play in an arcade where you'd play Pac-Man or whatever else it was, or you'd be sitting in your living room with one friend and you're playing against each other. But for most young people now, it's about having them playing against a multitude of online players who they've never met in person. Do you think that this experience of X-gen parents and the perspective they have on gaming influences how they then judge or look at their young children or young people who are currently involved in the gaming world?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think there are a lot of different perspectives about video games and video gamers, what they look like, who they are. You only need to do a quick Google search and sort of the media to see some of those sort of perspectives being being portrayed. So yes, absolutely. I think that definitely has a part to play. You know, it's important to recognize that video games have made, you know, significant developments, you know, even in the last like 5 years, their capacity to interact has sort of expanded quite in quite an exceptional way. They have that increased capacity to interact, and you know, they have more immersive gameplays, better graphics. There's all types, all sorts of different ways that video games have developed. So yeah, I think sometimes that perception of, you know, maybe arcade games or just single person playing by themselves, while that absolutely can be the case, it may be an outdated sort of understanding of what might be happening as well.
Yeah, because there probably will be quite a few people who still do those on their own gameplay, but the majority, I'm assuming, of people, especially younger people, play with others online, whether it's just with their friends or with people they don't necessarily know. So having a perspective of, actually, it's not like it used to be. It can be, but it's not always. So there is it's about the nuance of how, of the type of game, how it's played, where it's played, and the engagement with those games, which I think parents don't always think about. They kind of have a singular, or you're playing a video game.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is really important to try, you know, engage with people to understand how they're, you know, using that form of media, because absolutely you're right. It can be completely different to what your preconceived ideas and, you know, assumptions about what they're doing. So yeah, absolutely. It is really important to understand, because it can be done in so many different ways and for so many different motivations and for so many purposes.
Yeah. And it goes back to that uses and gratifications of why people game or spend time online. So a number of parents and especially the media, they kind of talk about screen time as a very generic word, that an overarching term that they use to describe a child or young person sitting in front of a screen playing video games. What is your perspective on that kind of screen time versus whether or not someone's spending it on social media or gaming?
Absolutely. A very good question. A classic question in our discipline about screen time and how it relates to engagement. There's lots of research to suggest, and you know, this is not just the case in video games, but a lot of other digital media, as you sort of were alluding to in the question, that what you play and how you play it is a far better predictor of your outcomes than how long you've been playing it. So Dr. Andrew Campbell, when he was on the podcast, had a fantastic tool that he had developed about, you know, how different media might be, you know, very beneficial, and we can't really sort of make some blanket statements about, you know, just because you've been gaming for this particular amount of time necessarily means that it's bad. Motivations for gaming can be, you know, as broad as, you know, to connect, to be able to achieve something, to escape or to take a sort of mental break from day-to-day life. And all of those are really valid ways of engaging or engaging with video games, and are actually quite common for other hobbies, you know, like social sport, soccer, knitting, reading, all of those kind of activities. You know, those motivations can hold true for as well. So yes, I think an interesting conversation, but more important about how you're engaging with the video game as opposed to how long you're engaging with it.
So it's kind of we're pathologizing something. And that kind of leads me into the next question about the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is now the DSM-5, because it's the fifth edition of it, and which most psychologists and psychiatrists use to diagnose mental health issues. Talk about internet gaming disorder as being something that needs further research. So do you think that gaming, or stating gaming as a disorder, is part of what is pathologizing what really is essentially mostly normative behavior amongst young people?
It's a very good question, and there is a very lively debate in the literature around gaming as an addiction, or the conversation that, you know, addiction might pathologize what might be sort of a new cultural norm. So for a bit of context, the World Health Organization officially recognized gaming disorder as a diagnosable condition in the International Classification of Diseases, which took effect in January 2022. But the American Psychiatric Association, as you mentioned, has only proposed that internet gaming disorder might be included in future manuals. So they put it in a section called Conditions Warranting Further Research. So some of the proposed criteria for that would be sort of unsuccessful attempts to control or reduce gaming, gaming to escape negative moods, and withdrawal symptoms when gaming is taken away or not possible. So there's definitely a conversation to be had around healthy versus unhealthy gaming. But we should also definitely consider in this conversation that high engagement doesn't necessarily mean addiction.
I think that's a good point, because we can, if someone plays a lot of football, we'd go, oh, great, they're very enthusiastic, they're very focused, they're very athletic. But if someone plays a lot of games, they go, oh, they're addicted. So we kind of, there's a very different criteria that we use to judge specific behavior. And then we kind of go, oh, I wonder if we need to send them to someone to talk about their addiction. So it's really putting it into context of why they're using it. And you spoke about using gaming to escape negative behavior, but sometimes we can go play sport or go running to escape negative behavior. So it doesn't mean that just playing a game because you're struggling, that actually you need to pathologize. It's just, you're struggling at the moment, you need to escape. This is how you go about doing it. And that's okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think you captured that nuance really, really well.
And we chatted in our initial discussion about the Cinderella Law. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, absolutely. So the Cinderella Law was something that was put forward in South Korea. And we've sort of already touched on kind of the perceptions of gamers a little bit. So the perception was that young people were engaging at rates far higher than what they were wanting. So they put in this law that banned underage players from engaging with video games between midnight and 6 a.m. This has since been repealed due to individuals, you know, getting around it quite successfully, parents wanting autonomy over how they parent their children, and also limited research to suggest that it was effective at its goal. So it is a very interesting case study in terms of potentially you know, we've got to be careful about how bans might be used and how they're implemented and operationalized, because we do need to understand how the media is being consumed. It's a very interesting case study in Australia at the moment. We're talking a lot about a social media ban for those under 16, which has come into some criticism from the research community for limited engagement with young people to understand how they're using it. So, yeah, I think that's an interesting conversation, and I think one that we're going to be having quite a bit for the next little bit.
Yeah, and I think the rest of the world's probably watching Australia from what impact will this have? And it's interesting you said with the Cinderella Laws that it kind of takes away parents' autonomy of how they actually want to parent their child. And I think there are probably some parents who look to the government or look to the education system to help them put in boundaries in place for their children rather than educating themselves about how to put these boundaries in place. So I wonder if there could be some backlash from parents kind of saying, actually, no, don't tell me what I should do with my child. But then there's other argument is that the government has laws around underage drinking or underage driving. So at what point is this an authoritarian governmental issue versus a parental issue? And I think there's going to be some really interesting discussions worldwide about the impact and how it actually rolls out in Australia and use it as a case study of whether they do or don't implement
something. Absolutely. Absolutely. Watch the space.
Watch the space. We'll chat about it again, I'm sure. Constant conversation. And then also one of the questions I often ask guests who in the gaming or do a lot of gaming research is, do you think there's such a thing as gaming addiction? And do we mislabel this gaming behavior as an addiction when actually it's not necessarily the case?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it goes back to whether, you know, your earlier question about whether a gaming disorder is sort of a valid disorder. It's an interesting discussion and debate and one that we absolutely should be having. At the moment, I'm not compelled by the research suggesting that gaming disorder is a stable enough construct. And not just an outlet for individuals who have sort of underlying causes that might be better explained by other disorders, anxiety, depression, things like that. But absolutely, I'm open to the possibility that that might be the case. And I think it'll be really interesting to see how that would work. We know that not all gaming is good. So we do have to consider some of the harms that come with gaming for excessive amounts of time, but also in specific contexts that might harm players. So we do need to acknowledge the good. There are definitely some good components of gaming, building community, an outlet for things, people enjoy it. There's lots of good elements to video gaming. But we absolutely have to consider some of the harms and look at that clinical context as well.
There are lots of very positive things about online gaming, but there are some people who really do struggle with excessive gaming. So are there any statistics on how many people are excessive gamers? And we're talking about the adult gamers probably more often than younger people, because there are young people who struggle a little bit more because they're not able to from a biological, mental, emotional perspective. But how many people do you think are excessive gamers, and what are the downsides of excessive gamers gaming?
Absolutely. So the prevalence of sort of gaming disorder or you know, disordered gaming, it varies across studies, you know, kind of reflecting different definitions and also kind of different methodologies. At the moment, the predictions are about 1% of gamers or less than 1% might suffer from that. And that's not to discredit, that's still a proportion of the population. We're talking about 3 billion gamers here. So potentially there is absolutely, you know, room that we need to look to for support for those individuals. So the sort of impact of excessive gaming, you know, has been this, you know, physiological effects. So musculoskeletal problems have been found in the literature, wrist, hand, back, neck pain, eye strain, sleep disturbances, and also hearing damage. So got to be careful in terms of excessive gaming as well.
And if there is an adult who feels that they spend too much time gaming or think that gaming may be negatively affecting their offline relationships or their work environment, because as you say, talk about, there's a lot of adults who kind of game way into the night, and if you fully immerse in the game, you lose track of time. So if they feel that their gaming is affecting their real life or negatively impacting their real life situations, do you have any advice for them on how they could better manage their gaming or their relationship with games?
Absolutely, absolutely. So the first thing would be to know the signs. So withdrawal completely from life outside video games is a good indicator that something might be wrong. So in that context, it would be best to have a chat to a trusted person around you, or speak to a doctor or psychologist if you're concerned. What I would say on this point is that, now studying the community of gamers, we know that there are a whole lot of really amazing individuals who want to support other gamers and want to see them sort of thrive as well. So, if you are a video gamer and you're watching, I would really encourage you to notice when other people around you are exhibiting those types of signs as well, and refer them on to support. And we know that referral from friends is one of the most powerful tools that we have for promoting a positive community. Another organization that I'd just love to mention is Safe in Our World. They're a mental health organization that looks specifically for the video gaming community, and is a really, really fantastic resource for those to reach out to and have a look and see what kind of support there is available through that network as well.
Do you know if there's anything on Discord that might help gamers? Because a lot of people, when I was speaking to Dr. Rachel Kurtz last time, is that she spoke about Discord and a lot of people are on there. Is there anything specifically on Discord that gamers might be able to reach out to or engage in?
Yeah, absolutely. So Discord, reaching out to community through Discord. So whether that's community that you're familiar with or more general sort of communities of support, we found that gamers are really receptive to helping one another. We found a strong theme of trust and reciprocity and helping. So absolutely going through a Discord channel or a network and finding support that way through that network may absolutely be an avenue that you seek support from as well.
So it's not just offline support. You can look online for people who you might not be engaging with on a physical basis on a day-to-day. So there's lots of different ways to get help. And especially for those who are in the community and might struggle, it might come across as something that is someone who gets me, someone who understands my stuff.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned there are some negative aspects of gaming, such as some level of discrimination against females by other gamers or other male gamers. Do you have any advice for female gamers who have felt the impacts of form of discrimination or negative statements made about them during a game?
Absolutely, absolutely. A really, really important component that we have to think about. So it is widely reported to be a really prevalent issue in the gaming community, along with sort of toxic behavior, abuse and mean comments towards women. So three things I would say. The first is to set boundaries and utilize game features. So many online games now have tools that allow players to sort of manage your interactions. You can mute and block and report players who are behaving inappropriately. The second thing you can do is finding supportive communities, may that be through Discord or other ways of connecting. So many female gamers find strength and camaraderie in joining some of those inclusive communities that foster that sort of trust and respect and kindness. We'd know that they exist. And the third thing and final thing I would say on this point is stand sort of strong in your identity. So the negative experiences women face in gaming can sometimes make you feel really unwelcome and hesitant to express yourself and engage in video games. Remember that your presence and participation in the gaming community is valid and valuable. Gaming is meant to be for everyone. And your identity as a female gamer is not only important, but contributes to a more diverse and enriched gaming community. So I would say that as well.
Extraordinary advice. Brilliant. But I think also maybe for the males who are maybe listening to this and do gaming is about helping each other to respect females. So standing up for females in their gaming community who may be discriminated against. And it's similar to if in a physical environment, if someone in your group is teasing a female or not being really respectful, is standing up and going, dude, no, this is not okay. Rather than just sitting back and being a passive observer of the situation.
Absolutely. We'd love fewer bystanders in that particular context and far more people to take action, like you said. So, when multiple people report and block particular individuals, it can definitely be more compelling to those particular gaming platforms that person might not be conducive to what should be a really positive gaming environment. So, yes, absolutely. A really brilliant point there.
It's kind of the social stigma of enough now. That's unacceptable behavior. Stop. So, and it's difficult sometimes to stand up to people who you're trying to impress or part of the community of. But I think we need more people to stand up and just say, no, that's not acceptable behavior. So we're coming to the end of the podcast, and there's three standard questions I normally ask my guests at the end. So the first one is, Emma, what is the most important question I haven't asked you yet?
A very good question. I think, why or how can somebody who's interested in this area get into cyber psychology? I think that's a really, really good question. So how I would answer that would be, why first, would be that cyber psychology is an incredible field answering some of the most important questions that have really direct impacts on policy and people. And hopefully some of the discussion that we've had today highlights that. So it is a really important field. So how can you get involved, find support, reach out to the community? It is a really lovely network of people who are doing research in this area. So you may want to consider going to conferences or, everyone that I've spoken to has been so lovely in terms of helping out in terms of support as well. So reaching out, asking for support, and to see who might be interested. And I would absolutely encourage anyone who's interested in this particular area to reach out to me and to have a chat. Would absolutely welcome that as well. We also have the Cyber Psychology Conference happening in Sydney next year. Next year. I'm getting 2024, 2025 mixed up. So next year, which will be really fantastic. If you are available in sort of July, it will be a really awesome networking opportunity as well to be able to meet other people interested in this. I know if you're from the UK, so it is a very, very far journey, but it's worth it, we promise.
We're chatting before we started recording about how actually with cyber psychology, it's still a relatively small community of cyber psychologists or psychologists in general. So it's a much tighter community and a much more welcoming community potentially than other areas of psychology, like, for example, educational psychology, where there's so many psychologists in that area. So even going to a conference or chatting online, it's really welcoming, and you get to meet a lot of people in higher levels of the career or who are more advanced in the career, and they're very open to having conversations with you because it is such a small community relatively. So that's part of what's really great about this. And as you say, networking, reaching out to people, they're so much more open in this area to welcoming everyone in and saying, yeah, let's support each other and grow this area of research. So
absolutely, absolutely.
And also the second question is, there's often a frustration among cyber psychologists around media misinformation. So taking academic findings and kind of skewing it slightly to sensationalize it and foster clickbait and moral panic and negative social narratives around digital technology. Do you think the media is getting better or worse at accurately representing sound academic findings?
It's a very, very good question. And I really enjoyed listening to everyone's perspective on this question as well through your episodes. I think it's definitely a mixed bag. I think there are some amazing publishers who are getting it absolutely right in terms of, you know, trying to get out research findings in an appropriate way that best articulate what has been done and how it's impacting people. So I think that's really awesome. There's obviously, you know, other clickbait type, moral panic in terms of reporting. So I think definitely a mixed bag. What I would say in terms of this question is, disseminating academic research and findings is absolutely imperative. So the media plays a role, but so too do we as researchers. So I don't take that lightly at all. You know, to research in a silo isn't to share our findings and to, you know, potentially help other people with the research that we're doing. So it's almost a moral imperative to be able to research and then to share what we found if it could help people, you know. So if you are a budding cyber psychologist and you're, you know, interested in the field, and you've got ideas of how we as researchers can also better get across our message, I think that everyone in the field would be absolutely open to hearing them, to try and, you know, research that isn't sensationalized or fosters moral panic, but really gets to the core of what we're trying to do and appropriately disseminates what we're finding, whether that's an amazing podcast like this, whether it's, you know, the intersection of science and art. You know, I think there's so many different and cool innovative ways of communicating science. And I think we as researchers have a role to play as well in that area.
I love that turn of phrase. It's morally imperative that we as cyberpsychology researchers and academics and people in the field to get that message out there as quickly as possible and disseminate those really key bits of information to change narratives away from negative stuff to more positive stuff. So it really is part of our job to do that and make sure that it's disseminated. So, yeah, good point. I love that. Emma, the final question is there any particular cyber psychology book that you'd recommend for people to read? Or it could be a researcher who's doing anything specific, or something that's not maybe cyber psychology book, but in your specific area, for someone to find out more about what you're doing?
Absolutely. And also fantastic to hear everyone else's recommendations. I don't know if anyone's recommended this one, but this is a book, and I have it on hand, which is helpful. It's called Issues and Debates in Cyber Psychology, and it's by Dr. Linda Kay. It is one of the most fantastic summaries of our field, of the sort of journey of the research in this area, but also where it's going. It's full of some fantastic references and resources, and is such a great starting point for anyone who is interested in anything to do with cyber psychology. A great chapter on screen time, stuff on video games. There's a whole lot of incredible information in this book. So if you don't have it already, I would definitely recommend this one.
And it's not a very thick book, so it's easily consumed in a very short space of time. Exactly. And she's now Professor Linda Kay, the legendary Professor Linda Kay. And she's really kind of disseminated some interesting stuff into and puts it across in a way that you kind of go, oh, yes, I get it now. I understand. And she goes into the nuances of screen time and gaming. So it's a great start if you want to pick up something and find out basics about cyber psychology from an academic perspective. Great book. Great recommendation.
Fantastic. Rigorous, interesting. Yeah, absolutely.
Emma, thank you so much for your time and for sharing your knowledge and insights. And I really appreciate you coming on Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. Thank you very much. And I look forward to chatting to you again about other areas of research and gaming.
Awesome. Thank you so much. It's been such a great pleasure.